Hello, my name is James Thomas, and welcome to my podcast, Don't Let God Put You Off the Bible. Yes, against all odds and sensibilities, we're here again. You, me, and my faithful friend Johnny Walker, blended whiskey. Here again to take a directionless meander through biblical anomalies that leave you wondering, really? So let's start off proceedings with the section where I give you the heads up on the very latest happenings within the world of biblical archaeology, so you don't have to do all that article reading legwork. So, the oldest Canaanite written sentence has been discovered at Lachish, which is southwest of Jerusalem, between Jerusalem and the Gaza. The sentence is written on a knit comb. It dates to around 1700 BC, so a little before Joseph purportedly arrived in Egypt. That is, depending on which historian you wish to go with. This is not the oldest example of Canaanite script, but it is the oldest example of a full sentence. The inscription on the comb reads, "May this tusk root out the lice of the hair and beard." The comb was called a tusk because it was fashioned from ivory, probably elephant ivory from Egypt. And not only do we have an inscribed knit comb, we also have proof that it worked and was used as such. On close analysis, nestled in the crook of one of the fractured teeth, a dead knit was discovered. So, with an eye to the trend of archaeology looking more and more at everyday life, you really aren't going to get more everyday than this, are you? You're up to date. The next section is, well, I never knew that, more surprising little facts buried deep in biblical history that are generally not known. The destruction of Jerusalem and the Second Temple in 70 AD, led by the Roman generals Vespasian and then his son Titus, was prompted by a Jewish uprising. The uprising was messianic, and behind it lay the star prophecy in Numbers 24:17. "There shall come a star out of Jacob, and a scepter shall arise out of Israel, and shall smite the corners of Moab, and destroy all the children of Sheth." And it goes on to say, "Out of Jacob shall come he that shall have dominion," etc., etc. This was actually a prophecy referring to King David, but it gave the more zealot Jews of the 1st century AD a proof text that convinced them a ruler would come forward and make them victorious over the Romans. As a point to note, this prophecy wasn't even uttered by a Jewish prophet, but a Gentile one, Balaam. But here's the rub. Josephus, as you probably know, was a Jewish historian who wrote expansive works on the story of the Jewish nation. He is the sole reason we know so much about 1st century Israel and the intricate detail of the siege of Jerusalem by the Romans. I promise you, any biblical or even just Middle Eastern historian or archaeologist will have a copy of the works of Josephus on their bookshelf somewhere. Anyway, Josephus started off as a commander in the Jewish army in control of Galilee. When the Roman war machine finally reached the walls of Jerusalem, our fine young commander surrenders and continues to ingratiate himself with the Romans. And how does he do this? It's a belter. He applies the star prophecy to the Roman general Vespasian. Josephus predicts that he will be the scepter to rise out of Israel and for him to have dominion. And guess what? Vespasian is so chuffed with this little prediction, he gives Josephus his last name, Flavius, and makes him historian to the emperor, which Vespasian duly becomes. Josephus had taken a proof text that stood at the very heart of the reason for the uprising by the Jews and turned it against them, applying it to the highest order of their enemy. And how do we know this? Because he bloody well tells us. What he did was a total betrayal of his own race, and he, as cool as you like, lets us know in a kind of, oh, and here's a giggle for you, you'll never guess what I did kind of way. The front of the man is staggering, but there you have it. For hundreds and hundreds of years, we have been, and still are, reliant for a majority of our knowledge of first century Palestine and surrounding areas on an historian who would have sold his own grandmother for a couple of denarii. And so we come to what I rather optimistically bill as the main event. And it's a little secret about Jesus, buried deep. In Mark, the Gospel generally accepted as the earliest, we have Jesus being quizzed by a high priest. Art thou the Christ, the Son of the Blessed? And Jesus replies, I am, and you shall see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power and coming in the clouds of heaven. Mark 14:61-62. This seemingly straightforward statement by Jesus is absolutely mired in controversy and opposing opinions that mainly focus on the I am quote, and you shall see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power quote. But for this podcast, I want to focus on the second part of the statement, and coming in the clouds of heaven. There's no getting away from the fact that the two parts are inseparably linked. But I don't want to be dragged into the intricate argument over what did the Son of Man actually mean. I want to see why clouds blew into the mix. Why is Jesus saying that the Son of Man will be coming in the clouds of heaven? Is this an idea innovated by Jesus himself? Does he see himself returning as Messiah and storming back to earth for the final conflict with evil on a kind of cloud chariot? Is this his own personal vision? Well, almost certainly not. Let's skip back a couple of centuries to the 2nd century BC. This is the time that Daniel was written, really the first full-blown piece of apocalyptic scripture. Daniel has a vision in the night, the famous chapter 7. Here he sees all the empires in the past and future, the Babylonian, the Persian, the Greek, etc., rise and then be destroyed. And then the Ancient of Days turns up, who is generally accepted as being God. He gets out the Book of Judgment and takes away all the power from the previous evil rulers. And then something a little strange happens. A new character appears. He is named as One Like the Son of Man. And the Ancient of Days bestows on him leadership of the entire planet. So this is obviously a divine figure who God is passing on dominion of the world to. And here is how the One Like the Son of Man makes his entrance. I saw in the night visions, and behold, One Like the Son of Man came with the clouds of heaven. Daniel 7:13. So there are those clouds again, a good couple of hundred years before Jesus mentions them. That's twice now that the clouds have been used to herald the arrival of a divine figure. And there's absolutely no doubt Jesus would have been very familiar with the book of Daniel. Jesus himself was almost certainly apocalyptic. And if you're apocalyptic, you knew Daniel. But wait, Daniel's figure is described as one like the Son of Man. The Gospels talk about the Son of Man. This has more to it than meets the eye. Up to and including the time of the writing of Daniel, the title Son of Man was used by Jews to refer to a human being. Daniel's figure only looks like the Son of Man, but is very definitely divine. The Ancient of Days is going to hand over the kingship of the world to him. But by the time we reach the writing of the Gospels, the Son of Man has become divine. And, as if to emphasize the point, he comes in on the clouds of heaven. Look, he's riding a cloud just like Daniel's divinity, so he's divine, right? And to make things more complicated, chapter 7 of the book of Daniel itself seems to reflect a transition of traditional Jewish belief. Brace yourself. Up to the Babylonian exile, the Messiah was God's representative on earth in the form of King of Israel. As I am sure you know, Messiah in Hebrew means anointed one. The line of Davidic kings from Saul onwards were referred to as Messiah. Then came the exile, and the Davidic line of kings was lost. Less than 100 years later, the exiles returned to Judea, and a new expectation seems to form. The nebulous of what would become the apocalyptic movement. The idea formed that a Davidic king would appear and not only reunite Israel, but in his role as Messiah king, he would fight off all enemies, leaving Israel to live in peace forever. Between the return of the exiles and the writing of Daniel, two transformations have happened. The Messiah, the king, has become divine, one like the Son of Man arrives from heaven in clouds and given kingship. And two, he is no longer going to be just the king of Israel, he is going to rule over the entire world. And I quote Daniel, "And there was given him dominion and glory and a kingdom that all people, nations and languages should serve him." 7:14. So by the time of Daniel, we have a divine Messiah coming to rule the world. And guess what? A couple of hundred years later, give or take a few, he turns up in the form of Jesus. And unbelievably, he turns up in clouds from heaven, just as predicted. So is it from Daniel that the clouds of heaven imagery gets its genesis? No. Let's roll back to Ezekiel. Ezekiel is kind of proto-apocalyptic in so much as it recounts a revelation that was shown to the prophet. And in this revelation, our old friend, the clouds turn up. Ezekiel was probably written in the early 6th century by a Jew exile in Babylon. The exiled Jews had lost their temple, destroyed by the Babylonians, and been taken from their land. They were struggling to have conviction in a religion that was essentially temple-based, in a land that they no longer lived in, and with no temple. In Ezekiel's vision, God comes riding into Babylon on a huge chariot driven by four beasts. "Fear not, your God has wheels. He's mobile. Your God can travel," seems to be the message. Suddenly, God has become mobile, so no need to worry about Judea or the destroyed temple. I'll come to you. And guess what? I'll read it for you. "And I looked, and behold, a whirlwind came out of the north, a great cloud and a fire enfolding itself." Ezekiel 1:3. We have a cloud. The chariot arrangement is within this firmament, as it is called. And above this is a throne. And I quote again, "And upon the likeness of the throne was the likeness as the appearance of a man above upon it." Ezekiel 1:26. We are a step away from one like the Son of Man, and the clouds are in attendance again as usual. When a divinity comes calling, it seems you should expect clouds. Is this, then, the first reference to clouds signalling the arrival of a divinity? No. Isaiah was written in at least two different time periods, at least two. The earliest writings were penned, probably, in the 700s, and they include chapters 1 to 39. From chapter 13, Isaiah begins to prophesy against Israel's enemies. He starts with Babylon, obviously, and then moves through the Philistines, Moab, etc., until we get to Egypt. Chapter 19, verse 1. "See, the Lord rides on a swift cloud and is coming to Egypt. The idols of Egypt tremble before him, and the hearts of the Egyptians will melt with fear." God is arriving on a cloud, and he is going to put the Egyptians through misery. The writing down of Isaiah, at least the first part, is not far away at all from when, in general, the Bible first started to be committed to the written word. This is a bit of a controversial subject, but it is highly unlikely that any organized writing had developed in Israel before the period of the kings. The setting up of a royal court would have sparked the need for a development of written records, but it would have taken a long time for this initial requirement for basic record keeping to develop to the stage where it became sophisticated enough to produce the scriptural writings. Most religiously disinterested scholars put the beginning of the recording of what was to become the Old Testament in either the 8th or 7th century, and some even put it as late as the 6th century. So to get back to it, the first part of Isaiah could well have been written very early. So the divinity arriving on a cloud imagery could well have been an earlier tradition that until then had been purely oral. Go further back in the Bible to 2 Chronicles. I'm not saying this was written earlier, but the setting is earlier. The Ark of the Covenant is being brought into the temple built by Solomon. Then the temple of the Lord was filled with cloud, and the priests could not perform the service because of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord filled the temple of God. 5:13. Again, the presence of God heralded by the appearance of a cloud. Let's go back further in time. Exodus 16:10. Moses and the refugees are still wandering in the desert, and the Israelites are grumbling about the lack of decent food. We're in the manna and quail story here. While Aaron was speaking to the whole Israelite community, they looked towards the desert, and there was the glory of the Lord appearing in a cloud. The Old Testament appears to be littered with references linking the appearance of God with an accompanying cloud. This seems to be a very deep set tradition. In fact, there are indications that this tradition could go all the way back to way before the Israelites first put pen to paper, and even had begun to form what was to become the Israelite religion. Ugarit, or Ugarit, however you wish to pronounce it, was a Bronze Age city in northwest Syria, on the Syrian-Turkish border, to be exact. The Ugaritic texts are a series of ancient clay tablets recovered when the until then lost city was discovered in 1928. These tablets were written in an early Semitic language, and they have been dated to around the 14th/13th century. This is important to us for two reasons. Back in this time period, this part of Syria was situated in the general area that was designated as Canaan. And secondly, the tablets detail religious beliefs held by the Canaanites just at the time when the Israelites were forming their own belief system. This gives us a rare opportunity to compare the early religion of the Israelites with their closest neighbours and check for any similarities. And what we find is really quite interesting. The story that the tablets relate to is generally called the Baal cycle. And it starts off with El, the top Canaanite god, appearing to want to hand over the reins of power to a younger god. This just so happens to be his son, Yam, god of the sea or water. Now, step forward and remember the book of Daniel. Daniel's having all sorts of visions in chapter 7 about beasts rising up, which we read to be the empires gone by, and then God appears and calls judgment on them. In verse 9, we have the description, "The Ancient of Days did sit, whose garments were white as snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool." And after destroying all before him, as we saw before, something curious happens. "Behold, one like the Son of Man came with the clouds of heaven, and came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. And there was given him dominion and glory, and a kingdom that all people, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion." You can't help but draw similarities to the Ugaritic text plot theme. We have an old god handing over the reins of power to a newcomer. But it gets even more intriguing. El's son Yam does not end up taking the reins of power because he is challenged and defeated by a pretender to the throne called Hadad. Hadad was the god of storm, thunder and rain. Hadad takes the throne and becomes Baal Hadad. Baal simply means lord in the Canaanite language. After he has defeated Yam, Asherah, consort to El, tears him off a strip with these words, and I quote, "Shame, victorious Baal, shame, rider on the clouds." There you have it. The new top dog, Baal, is a cloud rider. Is it at all possible that this tradition of the highest deity being pictured as a cloud rider could have survived through the formation of the Israelite religion and on through to the Old Testament and on into the New Testament? When Jesus in Mark says to the high priest after being asked if he is the Son of the Blessed, "I am, and ye shall see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power and coming in the clouds of heaven," is he simply quoting an old Canaanite tradition? Like most things in this field of study, it's impossible to tell for sure. All you can do is join up the dots and draw your own conclusion from the picture. But I think you'll agree, these dots make a pretty interesting picture. And here's one more thing to ponder. After Baal, previously known as Hadad, defeats Yam, he then goes on to fight and kill Mot, the god of death and sterility. He defeats death. We know someone who did that a couple of thousand years later, don't we? Please accept that I have very much simplified the story related in the Ugaritic texts, but what I quoted is in them. The dots are all definitely there, and I, for one, have spent a lot of time staring at this picture. If we go back to Mark and the scene where Jesus is being interviewed by the high priest asks, "Art thou the Christ, Son of the Blessed?" Jesus replies, as we heard previously, "I am." This small statement is thought by many to be the statement that causes the high priest, in the next line, to rent his clothes, and I would imagine get pretty flustered. This is because "I am" is how God names himself to Moses. So if the high priest reads this statement of "I am" by Jesus to be him claiming to be God, then yes, he would have got upset. But Jesus has been asked a direct question: "Are you the Christ, Son of the Blessed?" Surely the high priest would have had to at least ponder the reply he got, because it could be read in different ways. Was Jesus saying, "Yes, I am the Christ, Son of the Blessed"? Then he has not been blasphemous. The King of Israel, from David down, could be referred to, and often was, as the Son of God. And the name Christ was Greek for Messiah, also, traditionally, the role given to the King of Israel. If Jesus was answering in a literal way, "Yes, I am the Christ, Son of the Blessed," then at worst, he was being deluded, but not being blasphemous. If he had simply answered, "I am," and stopped there, surely the high priest would have had a "what the hell does he mean by that" moment, at the very least, and would have probably asked Jesus to clarify himself. But no, he instantly reacts by renting his clothes. Could this be because Jesus backs up his statement of "I am" with, "and you will see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power and coming in the clouds of heaven"? Was Jesus using this imagery of a tradition dating back to the origins of the Israelite religion to signal his divinity? If "I am" as an answer was a little oblique, then for Jesus to back it up with claiming that he was going to arrive on clouds would have made it more than clear that he saw himself as a divine God, and that certainly would have caused a bout of clothes renting, I would imagine. Jesus talks of the Son of Man arriving in the clouds of heaven. Daniel talks of one like the Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven. And the Ugaritic texts don't mention the Son of Man, but have a God being referred to as a cloud rider. Tradition would have obviously evolved, but it does seem, since long time past, clouds were the preferred travelling companions of divinities. Of course, we don't really know if Jesus even spoke these lines, because the Gospels can't be verified as completely accurate. And some might say they were completely inaccurate. But it is quite thought-provoking to have the possibility that the apocalyptic Jews at the time of Jesus were operating within a belief tradition, if you like, that came from Canaanites. And, in fact, from earlier than that, the whole story in the Baal cycle can be traced back over time and location as far as the Indus Valley. It's a fascinating topic of study and one well worth pursuing. Thank you so much for joining me on another ugly ramble through beautiful literature, hand in hand with the evil spirit of Johnny Walker Red Label. My name is James Thomas, and this has been another podcast from Don't Let God Put You Off the Bible. Please do drop by next time.